You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In the 1870s, three women being treated for hysteria in the Salpêtrière Hospital in Paris became virtual celebrities. Medical Muses, Hysteria in 19th Century Paris by Astier Husvet, tells the story of how Blanche, Augustine, and Genevieve captured the imaginations of 19th century Parisians, including many writers, painters, and journalists. Ms. Husvet was on the show in August. We're playing that conversation for you again today. I began by asking, doesn't hysteria come from the Greek word for uterus?
It does. It does. It's a disease that had existed for centuries before Charcot wrote about it. And he, however, insisted that it was a neurological disorder that could afflict both men and women.
But up until then, it was seen mainly as a female condition?
It was seen as an exclusively female condition, and Charcot was the first to argue that it was a neurological disorder.
How was it treated at the time?
Well, Charcot was less interested in treating it than he was in defining it, describing it. So he was a neurologist, and he was also the doctor that first described ALS, which is known in Europe as Charcot's disease and in the United States as Lou Gehrig's disease. And he took the same approach with hysteria.
Is the word hysteria even being used medically today?
It is no longer being used medically today, although apparently behind the scenes it's used frequently. But it is no longer an official medical diagnosis.
Charcot wrote about three phases of a hysterical attack. What were they?
Well, he wrote about often an attack would be preceded by an aura, and then women would have seizures that mimicked an epileptic seizure. And then they would have movements that looked like acrobatic movements, and it was often followed by passionate poses or passionate attitudes that where they would reenact traumatic events from the past, and it would then end with something, with delirium.
Were people doing this sort of thing? Then we don't see that today, do we?
No, I think something happened in the clinic. The women who arrived, Charcot's patients arrived with symptoms. He did not invent them. And at the same time, I believe that while they were in the hospital, their symptoms were molded to fit this clear-cut prototype.
So to some degree, they were performing what was expected of them.
They were performing what was expected of them, but that doesn't necessarily mean they were faking it. I don't even know if it was a conscious performance.
Well, it's like a psychiatrist told me once that if you go to a Freudian, you dream Freudian dreams. If you go to a Gestalt therapist, you dream Gestalt dreams. It's all just a matter of how to communicate the what's going on in your unconscious. Of course, they didn't know about the subconscious then, did they?
The unconscious was not an explanation for these symptoms. And at the same time, Charcot did write about what psychic trauma. So, for example, if someone fell off of a horse and experienced a paralysis afterwards that had no physical source, just the idea of the paralysis could create the paralysis.
To some degree, some of these things sound like PTSD today.
Absolutely. I think that what happened, for example, following World War I, when all of these soldiers returned from the trenches of World War I suffering from hysterical paralysis and nightmares, doctors were hesitant to label them as hysterics, and therefore the euphemism shell shock was born. And it changes with every war.
What was Jean-Martin Charcot's background like? He was also an artist, wasn't he?
He was an artist, and as a child, he drew all the time. And when he was deciding on where to go to school, he had first considered art school and then went to medical school. But even as a doctor, he focused on the visual, on the symptoms, and on drawing his patients, and many of the doctors that studied with him were also artists.
They didn't take photographs?
They did take photographs. So the Salpêtrière was one of the first hospitals to incorporate the new science of photography into the clinic, and it was used to document hysteria. And there's many, there's hundreds of beautiful and extraordinary images.
Your specialty has been literature. How did you come to write a book about hysteria?
Well, when I was a student in Paris, and hysteria was very much in the air. There had been it was the 1980s, and
just about the time they stopped using it in psychological circles.
Well, they stopped using it actually somewhat earlier. Maybe Freudians continued to use it, but it had been dropped from the DSM, which is the Bible of psychiatry, as early, I believe, in the 1950s. So. But it continued to live in literary theory and cultural theory, and it was very much in the air. And I was writing my dissertation on a late 19th century French writer, and I wrote a chapter on how hysteria influenced his work.
Has this become a feminist issue?
It's absolutely become a feminist issue. I think feminists latched onto it as a form of both as a... That hysterical symptoms were the ways in which women literally enacted their position in society, that they were crippled, paralyzed. And then it also became, some feminists latched onto it as a form of protest. And so feminists are largely responsible for continuing to talk about hysteria.
Your book focuses on the stories of three women, Blanche, mm-hmm. Augustine, and Genevieve.
Mm-hmm.
Are those their real names?
Those are their real names. And when I first started writing, I needed permission to access the medical archives in Paris because it's protected by privacy laws.
Even though we're talking about 150 years ago?
Yeah, I think French privacy laws are stricter, but somehow at first it wasn't clear whether I could use their real names or not. And as it turned out, I was allowed to use their real names, both their first and last names.
How old was Augustine when she was admitted?
She was young. She wasn't even 14. So she was, she had just turned 14. So she was just a girl.
And what was she doing that led to her being committed?
She had been her mother had basically given her as a sexual favor to her employer. And she had resisted his advances, and she was raped. And it was following these very brutal rapes that she ended up having her first hysterical attacks and was sent to the hospital.
Did the other women have similarly traumatic experiences?
Yeah, I think all of the women, the Salpêtrière was a public hospital, and it really, the women who ended up there were mostly from the lowest echelon of society. And all of the three women I write about had all had horrific childhoods filled with, just impossible and terrible abuse.
So we can understand why these women were troubled.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But hysteria seems to be the wrong diagnosis ultimately, but it was the only one they had at the time?
My conclusion is not that it was the wrong diagnosis. I think what happens is that there are all kinds of illnesses that are culturally contingent and take place in a specific time and place. And these were symptoms that were available for these women to express their distress at that particular time.
Well, a lot of the treatments you write about seem pretty outrageous right now. There's a picture of an ovary compressor in your book.
Mm-hmm.
What was it supposed to achieve in the treatment of hysteria?
Well, I think, Charcot should be credited with moving away from the uterine theory. But in practice, he spent a lot of energy on the ovaries. And he thought he was... The Salpêtrière was a women's hospital, so his patients were women. But he mapped out the hysterical body in such a way that certain zones on the female body were privileged and could either start or stop in a hysterical fit. And the ovary compressor is this apparatus that really looks like a medieval torture device, a kind of vice grip that was strapped onto a woman's abdomen, and then there was a knob that was turned, and it would press into the ovary, and it really looks terrible. And at the same time, women, the hysterics often requested it. And one of the women, Blanche, was known to wear it for many hours. She would go about her business in the hospital. There was a gymnasium where the women could go and take gymnastics classes, and she would sometimes even participate wearing the ovary compressor.
Do you have any idea of why? I mean, it sounds like torture.
Well, I think what it was is that they participated enough in the entire hysteria project that their bodies responded appropriately. And I think that we all participate in our cultures in a way, and our bodies are not exempt from that. And this is a more extreme example of what we all do.
My guest is Asti Hustvedt. Her book, Medical Muses, Hysteria in 19th Century Paris, is published by Norton. Now, Freud comes into this story.
Yes.
How did he work in this hospital?
Freud was a student of Charcot's. He was there for 6 months in, I believe it was 1985 or 1986, 1885, 1886, excuse me. And he translated Charcot's work, and he named one of his sons after Charcot, and he was deeply influenced by Charcot. And at the same time, when Charcot was writing, the unconscious was not a viable explanation for hysterical symptoms. So it was only later that Freud went on to write about the unconscious.
But hypnotism was employed as a mode of treatment. Hypnotism relies on the unconscious. Did people not make that connection?
No, I think when Charcot started using hypnotism and had been thoroughly discredited, and because he was perhaps the most famous doctor in Europe at the time, when he started using hypnotism, it got a lot of attention. And he didn't use it really to treat hysteria. He used it to reproduce hysterical symptoms in such a way that he could study them, that he could immobilize them and study them.
Well, one of the main concerns with hypnotism is that it can be very manipulative.
And it was absolutely manipulative, but he used it as a tool to recreate and represent hysteria.
I mentioned earlier that this was not just a matter of something that happened in a hospital, but the public got very interested. Mm-hmm. Why?
Well, I think a couple things were going on. Because Charcot became very, very famous, he had rivals and who wanted to discredit him. And one of the ways and he was also a bit of a showman. So he wanted to open up the doors of the hospital to show people that he wasn't inventing this, that it was actually happening. And one of the ways to do that was to open it up to the public.
Which is an invasion of the privacy of these patients.
Yeah, I think the whole notion of patients' rights and privacy had yet to be discovered. It hadn't happened yet.
You include a painting by André Breuillet called A Clinical Lesson at the Salpêtrière. So was he actually painting a session as it was taking place?
Well, I think he was painting it from memory, but you have all of Charcot's students, many of them who became famous doctors in their own right, are represented in the painting. Gilles de la Tourette, Joseph
of Tourette's syndrome.
Of Tourette's syndrome, and Joseph Babinski and Binet. If New Yorkers probably are, if they've sent their children to Hunter, you still have the Stanford Binet exam. So many of them are, and they're all represented. And Blanche is the woman in the photograph.
Well, you said that his work was controversial. There were people who were contesting his findings?
Yes, there were people who were contesting his findings. And at the same time, Charcot, until his death, really won out. He was acknowledged as the master.
The University of Nancy had problems with his work with hypnosis. Hypnosis is still being used today by some doctors. Are they following in Charcot's footprints?
No, not really. I think that hypnosis is more often used today to try to uncover something, a lost or hidden memory, to tap into unconscious impulses. And that Charcot really was using it in a way to empty out his women of anything that would get in the way of his theory.
Were there alternative theories? For example, did the church go along with Charcot's ideas?
Absolutely not. There was a big battle between the church and medicine for control of aberrant behavior, and in particular women's bodies. So Charcot, was anti-clerical, and he insisted that what the church thought of as either divine or demonic was simply hysterical or pathological.
So he was saying that if a saint had a hallucination, mm-hmm. that was pathological.
Mm-hmm. That it was not divine inspiration, but pathology. And there was a stigmatic at the time named Louise Lateau, who was in Belgium, and she was a contemporary of Charcot's, and she was being written about quite a bit. And what I find interesting is that Charcot, he insists that it's pathological.
Well, how did he explain stigma?
He as hysterical.
Stigmata, I mean.
Yeah, stigma as hysterical. So he does not dismiss it as a hoax or as fraud. He insisted that he had a clinic full of women who could bleed spontaneously, who had hallucinations, who went into religious ecstasies, who could live for long periods of time without eating, and that this was all symptomatic of hysteria.
What happened to his patients after he died?
Well, one of the women I write about who became, she was known as the Queen of Hysterics at the time, and she was the most famous of the hysterics. She never had another hysterical symptom after Charcot died. And she stayed in the hospital, and she first worked in the photography laboratory. She'd always loved the photographs and spending time there. And then she became a technician in the new science of radiology, and she died of radiology-induced cancer. So she lived. She never left the hospital.
Did any of them leave behind any writings about their experiences?
No. She was interviewed, and there was in their case histories. There sometimes letters are included, and some lots of their words are included in their case history. But if any of them did, I didn't discover it.
Well, Charcot is largely discredited today, and yet I get the feeling that you feel you would like to, in some ways, revive his reputation. Why?
Well, I think that I began the book with a preconceived idea that this was a situation of a misogynist man exploiting these women, and I ended up with something far more nuanced, and I became a reluctant fan of Charcot, who I think was a brilliant doctor. And the fact is, many of his neurological definitions are still on the books.
Such as?
Well, ALS, for example, multiple sclerosis, Charcot-Marie-Tooth disease, and a host of other neurological conditions. Hysteria was really his downfall. And what I find important, I think we're still stuck in this paradigm of illness is either real or not real. And if you suffer from something that's real, and real meaning we can find a biological marker, you suffer from something that's legitimate. But the moment that medical tests don't find anything, you're kind of cast off as someone who might, have something that's not legitimate. And Charcot insisted that hysterical symptoms were real. And he died before he fully articulated this, but he seemed on his way to articulating a paradigm that got past the mind-body thing that we're still stuck in.
But it sounds to me like the treatment relied on the placebo effect.
Well, but if
Blanche was wearing this this terrible ovarian suppressor, mm-hmm. And it was working, mm-hmm. that sounds to me like a placebo.
Sure.
And so if people are acting out in a way that is suggested to them by their doctor, they also are cured in a way that is suggested by their doctor.
Yeah. I think that Charcot never, as far as I know, he never actually used the term placebo, but the last thing he wrote before he died was on faith healing. And again, he doesn't dismiss the Lourdes sanctuary and the people who were healed there as he acknowledges it as a very real phenomenon. However, he does insist that they were hysterical. So as he says, no one with an amputated limb has ever gone to Lourdes and had the limb grow back. That would be, but
they have felt an itch at the end of the imagined foot.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. That exists.
Asti Hustvedt, her book, Medical Muses, Hysteria in 19th Century Paris, is published by Norton. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.